she taps into a kind of terror that lifts us as viewers into something that is really tragically all too real.
At its core, it is a show about the effects of trauma and abuse.
Audrey likes to start trouble or start situations for the sake of starting trouble or starting a situation.
While Twin Peaks the show has a retro feel, this week we see more instances of the modern world and technology.
Hello, you've once again found yourself with us at Back to the Double R, an end-to-end rewatch of the legendary television event Twin Peaks. This week's episode is Season 1, Episode 7, Realization Time. I'm Colin, and there's blood on my donut.
I'm Damon, and I'll be talking this week about Cooper's complex moral code.
Hi, my name is Jonathan, and we are going to talk about Sherilyn Fenn and her fabulous character, Audrey Horn.
And I'm Jennifer, and this week I'll be digging into the audiovisual, discussing the use of recording, playback, and feedback in this episode. This episode begins with Special Agent Dale Cooper returning to room 315 at the Great Northern to find Audrey Horn naked in his bed. Cooper gently friend-zones Audrey in order to maintain his professional standards. Some of the other relationships in Twin Peaks become more complicated as Leo finally discovers Bobby having an affair with Shelley. Big Ed attempts to console Nadine after the patent for her silent drape runners was rejected, and Sheriff Truman worries over Josie. The shady dealings between Leo, Hank, Ben Horn, Josie, and Catherine Martell grow more complicated. At Horn's department store, Audrey ferrets out the true nature of the business at One Eye Jack's and secures a meeting with its madam, Black Rose. Cooper has Sheriff Truman enlist the Bookhouse Boys on a mission over the Canadian border to One Eye Jack's, but not before he shares an insightful life philosophy with the sheriff. James and Donna use the tape they obtained from Dr. Jacoby's office to have Maddie pose as Laura in an attempt to lure the psychologist out of his office and find more clues. Leo silences Waldo the Minor Bird, but not before a recording of the bird talking about the murder was taped. Audrey's cover is nearly blown as she speaks with Blackie, aka Black Rose, but she saves her skin and impresses the madam by tying a knot in a cherry stem using only her mouth.
We're going to do a little regret here before we jump into the new business of this episode. Seeing as how we're definitely going to be talking about, morality, at least with both probably Agent Cooper and Sherilyn Fenn, I forgot to go over our character alignment for Margaret Lannerman, the Log Lady, last week. And when I'm looking at it, I'm going to put her as a chaotic good character, which according to the Wikipedia article says, a chaotic good character does what is necessary to bring about change for the better, disdains bureaucratic organizations that get in the way of social improvement, and places a high value on personal freedom, not only for oneself, but for others as well. Chaotic good characters usually intend to do the right thing, but their methods are generally disorganized and often out of sync with the rest of society. I think that might be a good place for Margaret Lannerman to live right now, because there's definitely an air of mystery, although she's always good intentioned. You never see her like do anything bad or harmful or evil, but she's kind of in her own world, marching to her own drum. So I feel comfortable putting her in that position. If anyone disagrees or has any feedback, I'm all ears.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah, I would buy that. I think there's an interesting issue when people are touched by the darkness, good people touched by the darkness can either turn evil or they can fall into this chaotic good category, maybe, right? Because, like Laura goes down the path of darkness. But Margaret, she's obviously been impacted. And I mean, she has this kind of second sight, but she retains her inner goodness. I'd be interested to think about that more in terms of the alignments that you're handing out, Jonathan.
It's sort of like she's a good witch, if you think about it, using the powers, totally. The dark powers for good.
In her cabin, hidden away from everybody. Yeah. And that's another, Jennifer, that's another good alternative position for a woman in this show, a position of power, although she is marginalized. But she still has a really important, she has a significant power and an important role.
Another couple of facts about the episode. It was originally broadcast May 17th, 1990, written by Harley Payton, and the first episode directed by Caleb Deschanel, who is an Academy Award nominated cinematographer. He's best known for his DP work, although he does do directing. He's had 6 Oscar nominations for that. So if this episode perhaps looks a little more dynamic than what we've seen so far, that's probably why, even though he's not the DP here. But you know, those guys, I think, always tend to think visually and look for interesting ways to bring that in. I also think the writing on this episode is particular because it's the first one that breaks sort of the form we've seen for Twin Peaks, where it opens in the morning, you know, usually with Cooper waking up at the Great Northern, and kind of they spend at least, you know, a day at doing it. This is the first episode where we're really going like right from the cliffhanger from, you know, the previous episode where we see, you know, Audrey in Cooper's bed, and it starts right at that exact same scene, which I think really does a nice job of like sort of raising the stakes of the episode and like, you know, giving a good sense of urgency for, you know, what we're going to have happen here, especially leading into next week, which is the season one finale. So, you know, how did you guys sort of just feel overall about the episode? Did it work for us? Are we, you know, fans of it, or, you know, how do we feel?
It's really interesting, Jonathan. When I first watched it, I was wondering, you know, what sticks out to me. And each time I rewatched it a few times, and I was kind of amazed by all the different things going on. I mean, this happens to me every time, where maybe on the surface there are a lot of plot things that go through, but the more you examine it, the more and more layers they are. So I really enjoyed this episode. I think there are a lot of clever things happening as far as threads that you could follow thematically and visually. And, you know, we're only going to touch on a few of them. And there are at least, I don't know, 5 more threads that I think would be worth having lengthy conversations about. So I liked it.
Well, and I like that we get this sort of mini cliffhanger right before the end of the season, which... you know, I won't spill any beans, obviously, but ends with, you know, several very major cliffhangers. So it definitely feels like the tension is being escalated as the various threads of the plot are sort of coming to a head in anticipation of the
season. Well, and I think the especially the 2 previous episodes have done like a lot of grunt work instead of like, you know, like really kind of like establishing some stuff about the mystery and like, you know, where some of the characters, it's almost as if the characters are wind up toys and, you know, they've wound everyone up. And like, this is the episode where they finally like release the, you know, the wind, and the characters are just sort of off to, you know, do what they're going to do. There's a lot of action here, right? The, you know, they make a trip to One-Eyed Jack's to go on a mission. Like Audrey, you know, has her sort of, you know, hey, I need to, you know, get into the One-Eyed Jack's myself, right? There's, you know, big, you know, revelations with like Bobby and Leo and Shelley and Big Ed and Norma. So yeah, like just, you know, finally, I think some of the characters just sort of let loose on their home, and, you know, we're going to see what they're going to do from here on out.
They are certainly busy this episode. I have to agree with you there.
So I'd like to kick off our discussion this week. I want to just point out a couple of things in this episode that fit the structural reading that I've been talking about. And then I have a couple of bigger ideas that I'd like to run by you all. So last week, the episode starts with a blood red moon. This week, the episode starts with a deep blue moon that Jennifer pointed out to me is in eclipse. And it's kind of unclear how we go from a full moon to, you know, we couldn't go from a full moon to a moon in phase. So something is happening here. And the color blue shows up at several key moments in the episode, most notably in Dr. Jacoby's office. If you look closely, you'll see his tie, you'll see the carpet, the batik he's leaning on. And we know that he's got these red blue glasses that he wears. So I think there's a challenge to us, the viewers, to change our lens this week and look through the other lens. Red last week, blue this week. There's also in the opening, there's this absolutely gorgeous blink and you'll miss it shot of the Great Northern. It's an exterior night shot where the hotel and the top of the falls are bathed in this ominous but beautiful blue light, and all around it is blackness, kind of like the city, as if Twin Peaks is becoming disconnected from the real world. And there's something to this idea that the action is starting to take off. It's almost like the show is blue shifting away from you. Or maybe Twin Peaks having kind of orbited into contact with the real world, where, Special Agent Dale Cooper could hop on board. It's now orbiting away again, disappearing again into the darkness. It's really just a flash of an image. It's almost even just subliminal, but I think that image is really powerful.
I love that shot so much.
It's amazing. It's really amazing. I want to track it down and, use it as my screensaver forever. This week, that question of what the show is doing that makes it unique really stood out for me. And this is the first big idea that I have for you. The shorthand version, which I think any viewer can see and we've all talked about, it's not really a big secret or anything, is the juxtaposition of something dark with something comic, with something sentimental, again and again in all kinds of combinations. And as this first season starts heading toward its crescendo in the next episode, I think we may be starting to see each category bleeding into the others. Just one version of this that I'll mention is the donuts at the station. It's night, it's raining outside, and there's a cut to the donuts, and there's this thunder cue that is just hilarious. They seem to be leaning more and more into the coffee and donuts, which makes you ask why, what is it? But they have this shot of the donuts, and then of course that scene ends with poor Waldo's blood spattering the jelly donuts specifically.
When I was a kid and I watched the show when I was 10, that image of the blood on the donuts, and I don't remember if they used it as like sort of like a commercial for like, oh, this week on Twin Peaks, but it like it's one of the first images of the show that sort of became lodged in my brain, is that that long row of donuts, then like just the blood there, and it's always stuck with me.
That's so funny. I bet they couldn't resist using that as a promo piece. It's great. So I think that there is some of this blending of genres around the edges, but there's still, plenty of great genre moments lined up. Lynch does this. He leads you partway down a path and then kind of pulls the rug out, leaving you shocked or forcing you to fill in the gaps with something that you didn't expect. It actually works a lot like comedy. If you watch a stand-up, a lot of joke structure is pulling you along, but then instead of giving you the straight payoff, they twist it, or it's, there's something bent about it, and your mind has to make a leap to connect the dots, and that's where the comedy is. I think that Lynch does that a lot. And if you took the episode apart, not that much happens that's really out there. There's, the Red Room, and there's some iconic images, but a lot of it is the cycling of genres that creates this mood that very few shows did at the time, and very few shows still can pull off today. I think part of the reason that they can do this is because they have amazing actors giving incredible performances. In this episode, we have what for me is a standout scene in TV. And this is where Shelley is just completely distraught and confesses to Bobby that she shot Leo. So this is my second big idea for you. I think there's a whole argument to be made about how the darkness centers, it has its primary roots in male power, and especially male power over women. Ben, Hank, Leo, Bobby, there's kind of this hierarchy of dark men, and they all treat women as property. Hank even suggests when he's talking about Shelley, just meat. So there's a lot there that we could unpack. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on that. But what I think is even more important is what Mae Janemic achieves in that scene. For me, she taps into a kind of terror that lifts us as viewers out of just a genre-driven show on ABC into something that is really tragically all too real. Issue of domestic abuse is complex and deep. Not a lot of television handles it well. And that question of where can I hide is one really devastating mode of it. Your whole world is torn apart. There's nowhere that's safe. And in that scene, I think she's just stunning. I think her work there actually kind of transcends the show and shows us one of the core ideas that Lynch is exploring in a lot of his film work, namely the way that men and male power terrorize women and destroy their sense of a world where they can be safe. When we see Shelley later at the diner, you'd never know anything is wrong because that's also part of the system. Your world can be turned inside out, but you still have to smile and serve the coffee. And, you know, what's scarier than that? And it's all the more so, of course, because it's real. So I think it's certain performances like that that make Twin Peaks more than just a great TV show, but also really show the power of the medium. You know, and here we are 30 years later talking about it. So they must be doing something right. So that's my two big pitches this week, this genre mashing and these moments where the cast and creators elevate the show and really do some powerful cultural work. And I'm wondering if you're seeing those things in the same or different ways, or what else stands out for you maybe as an example of this?
I have two observations about the scene that you're talking about with Shelley. Which is, I mean, she's so great in that scene. It feels so believable. The two things that stand out there to me, one is that my thinking about Twin Peaks has always been that, while it's about lots of different things, at its core, it is a show about the effects of trauma and abuse, not just on an individual, but on an entire community. Mm-hmm. And in general, when we think about that theme, we think about it in terms of what happened to Laura. But this is a moment where Shelley really shines out, and we can see this isn't just about Laura, right? This is about these sort of systems of violence, for lack of a better descriptor, that are at play in our society and certainly in this small, tight-knit community that is so, like, shiny and nice in so many other ways. The other thing that has always stood out to me about that scene, though, is when Bobby goes to try to console Shelley, the things that he says sound just like Leo. When he says, you know, I'm gonna fix Leo and I'm gonna fix James, and he's basically consoling her by saying, I'm going to commit further horrific acts of violence. And it definitely feels like a out of the frying pan and into the fire moment for Shelley when I watch that scene.
Totally. Well,
and one thing, you know, talking about the episode as a whole, you know, you're talking about all of these men and all these abusive situations, and think about One-Eyed Jax, and that there's this whole system in place connected with the Horn Department Store for literally plucking young girls from the perfume counter, you know, to have them be call girls. And so there's this whole nefarious system in place to abuse women. And I hadn't really thought about the whole show as being about abuse and trauma. But then if you think of this whole human trafficking aspect of things, it really amplifies that thought that you had there, Damon.
Well, and to me, all of the supernatural stuff that we see that's, you know, seemingly a different kind of darkness, a lot of that to me just feels like it's a sort of metaphorical expression of these real world traumas.
I want to stop for a second on that idea, because that is so important. And I absolutely fall into the trap of getting all excited about the supernatural implications and, oh, there's a darkness in the woods. And, you know, you're totally right, Damon, that however much there is, you know, imagery and structural points about this supernatural darkness, the truth is the darkness is right there in broad daylight, so to speak, for everybody to see.
Well, and, you know, the show, I think, you know, like it manipulates the audience along with like the characters on the show, because I think I mentioned last week or a couple weeks ago that, you know, there's definitely like A plots and B plots. And for Twin Peaks, you know, the A plot is who killed Laura Palmer. That's the, you know, that's the driving force of the narrative from the first moment of the pilot through really almost the whole entire show, if we want to, you know, break it down here for you. But like, it, you know, so this stuff with Shelley and Bobby, I mean, it's definitely B plot, right? It's, you know, it's a tangential part of the episode, but they've been preparing us the whole time with like these scenes of like, you know, great emotional outbursts or great emotional trauma. So, you know, even these B plots are tying into what we've been saying the whole time, right? Where, you know, this is a reaction to, you know, like a physical trauma, and you know, Shelley's truly terrified. It's not a question I think a lot of people do consider. Well, you know, if I leave Leo, like what happens to me next? And we forget that, I mean, Shelley's what, 18? You know, because she's supposed to be the same age as Bobby and Donna and all the other kids that are in high school. But, you know, this is a girl who dropped out of high school, you know, married probably, you know, the first, you know, smooth guy that, you know, came along and got her out of whatever, you know, horrible situation or, you know, like doldrum situation with her parents. And, you know, she's a true innocent here, right? So it's, you know, they never really stop to, you know, really like look at like, God, what's the worst thing that could, you know, be happening with Shelley? And it's like, what happens to me now? You know, it's almost like she has to, you know, be a part of like the cycle and can't imagine, you know, her life outside of it at all. And, you know, Maychen Amick, just, I mean, she's one of my favorite characters on the show. I also have a huge crush on her, always have had, but she's just amazing in this episode. I 100% agree. And I'm glad we're talking about her, because we've gone 7 episodes and haven't really talked about Shelley. I'm glad she's getting her due.
So I wanted to spend some time this week talking about Agent Cooper, and specifically his moral and ethical code. So on the surface, Cooper really seems like a Boy Scout. You know, he's straight down the line. Right is right, wrong is wrong. Lawman. But I think there's actually a lot more to Agent Cooper than meets the eye. Yes, he is a man with a very strict moral code and clear ideas about right and wrong. But as much as he talks about this at the start of the episode, when he finds Audrey in his bed, and he talks about sort of the Bureau and sort of idealizes the FBI in this way, and talks about this moral code that he's sworn to uphold, I think there's more going on there than he lets on, or maybe even that he lets on to himself. Cooper's deflection of Audrey's advances seem really genuine and really compassionate. And, you know, obviously he's doing the right thing here. He knows it would be wrong to get involved with a high school girl. But he doesn't just toss her out either, right? Even though her continued presence there could easily, you know, be misconstrued or jeopardize his career, he tries to be compassionate and still be her friend, which I think is really admirable. His friendship to people is obviously one of his greatest qualities. And we see his fierce loyalty to his friends similarly on display in his conversation with Truman about Josie. So Truman is very worried about the woman he loves, and Cooper sort of initially starts to ask some questions about the situation, and Truman tells him, basically, I love her and I'm worried about her. And Coop says, you know, that's good enough for me. We'll look into it. So even though he's there in town on a very specific mission, find out who killed Laura Palmer, you know, he's willing to sort of put in some extra work to help out his friends. And, you know, I think there's something too about his statement in that same scene about when he gambles with the Bureau's money. He always tries to bring back something extra. You know, he really idealizes the FBI. He sees himself as a representative of this very important institution. But at the same time, all of this is in preparation for a trip across international borders with a small town sheriff and a civilian in disguise to go undercover and infiltrate a brothel. This is hardly by the book. It is not the sort of thing that I would imagine Gordon Cole would give an immediate thumbs up to. And Cooper doesn't seem to have any hesitation or compunction about taking these steps that are, you know, going with the Bookhouse Boys and taking these steps that are clearly, you know, stepping out of his jurisdiction, potentially violation of international law. And in the scene with Audrey, he's just claimed that he has no secrets. But this trip to Jack's in and of itself is clearly a secret of sorts. And a couple episodes ago, we saw him, you know, sort of gesture towards this tragic history in the romance department. But there, he seemed to be intentionally quite vague and really secretive. So the question that I would put to you all is, how would we describe Agent Cooper's moral code? Is it just more complex than the law that he's sworn to uphold, or is he inconsistent? Is his approach to ethics actually compatible with being a good FBI agent? And is he being honest with himself about what his moral code actually is?
I mean, one thing that struck me, you mentioned that he said he didn't have any secrets, and a short time later, he's in the diner with Ed and he says, well, let me tell you a secret. So, like, we're introduced to this idea, and that secret has to do with giving yourself a gift every day. So that's more about a life philosophy at that point versus a moral code. I mean, I wonder about this $10,000, how on earth he got that from the FBI. I mean, that seems very, it seems like he would have to fill up paperwork to get the $10,000 to do this mission that is unauthorized. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he means well. He had this glee about him in being in disguise and going on this mission. So there's something that kind of, I don't know, it almost was titillating for him to be taking on this different role, even though he was in less of a disguise than anybody else, really. So I don't know. I'm not super troubled by it, because I think his heart is in the right place.
I don't think there's any question that he means well, but I just am not sure that he's being honest with himself about what he actually believes, because he does seem to delight in this sort of mischief and deception at the same time as he claims to have no secrets.
Well, this is the arc that he has to go through, or presumably, right? I mean, for a character in season one of a major tentpole show, you'd sort of expect more change than Cooper actually goes through. He's actually an incredibly sort of solid hub as a character. But, you know, in the previous episode, or we see him start to be ruffled by the Icelanders who are keeping him up, and he's actually vexed. He's has a bad morning. When we see him confront Audrey, he's starting to kind of crack. And so we're seeing him open up for the first time in this show, except for just, you know, a spare allusion here and there. And so, you know, it's really interesting. I think he is going to have to change. You know, I don't have the entire show in my head, but he's going to have to evolve. And, you know, this is a man who uses gravity boots as part of his work discipline. So, you know, that's going to be an uncomfortable process for him.
I think one of the, you know, the things you're seeing with Cooper is he's like starting to, he's starting to compartmentalize. Like he has like the history of his sort of, you know, romance that went awry. And so when, you know, he's there with Audrey, who he's clearly attracted to. I think that's like part of the, you know, the thing that you need to buy into. There is a scene, you know, a couple episodes where he's like, how old are you? And she's like 18. And he's like, oh, and I mean, it makes me think too of like when they used to have like those, you know, those countdowns, like when like the Olsen twins were going to be turning 18, right? Sort of tying into, you know, maybe some of the horrible misogyny you know, people have
so
had,
disgusting.
Right? Like, you know, He's like, oh, you're 18. And he kind of, you know, he has one of those sort of looks like, oh, okay. It's like, you know, like a little bit of a gleeful sort of information that he has, but he's also like, he knows, okay, this girl's still in high school. It would be improper. So he knows how to like put some of that stuff to the side, but then, you know, I think he also, you know, wants sort of that sense of adventure and, you know, he's friends with Truman at this point. Like he tells Truman that really fabulous advice about give yourself a present every single day. And I think maybe the present Cooper gives himself is like, hey, I'm going to put on a tux and like dress up and gamble with the FBI's money. You know, so you know, on the one hand, you have a guy who, you know, has like a strict moral code and like knows that, hey, you know, like I might be attracted to this high school girl who is clearly into me, but I can't cross that line. But yet, you know, you have like, you know, he's an adventurer in some ways. And so he's like, no, we're going to go to the border and, you know, check out this thing. And yeah, we're going to, you know, gamble a little bit and have some fun. And so I think that's, you know, but like, it's good that we're not seeing Cooper as like a total straight arrow, you know, in the, like in a show that is less interested in moral complexities. You know, you'd see, you know, your lead FBI guy would be completely static, right? He'd be like, no, like I'm the hero, you know, I got the badge, I'm always upholding the law. And I think Cooper in a lot of ways like is in that tradition, but they give him a lot of room to sort of flesh out his, you know, his kinks, his things that like turn him on, his things that like, you know, because he's a very sensual character. He loves food. He loves, you know, all these like sensations that he's feeling. He's, you know, he's going to give into that, maybe even to his detriment.
Yeah, he relishes the little indiscretions in having breakfast that isn't healthy for him. And he relishes gambling with, you know, the Bureau's money, but he always likes to bring a 10 to 15% return, which is perfect. Beautiful brushstroke.
He seems like a guy who would be good at counting cards.
Yeah. So he loves this danger as long as it's controlled, as long as he can control it. And that sets him up to be a character who is going to just, you know, or potentially is going to blow apart when he finally breaks.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think it's, you know, kind of what you're talking about, like with a noir, right? Often like noir heroes, like can't help themselves. Right. And I think, you know, there's a lot of like, I can't help myself with like Cooper here. And, you know, it's, you know, there's that tension. It's like, okay, well now that I've like opened this door, I'm not entitled, like, oh crap, I got to close it again. But I think he might not be able to, right? Or, oh, like that toothpaste is not going back in the tube, Agent Cooper. You know, you opened it and now, you know, you got to deal with it, man. It's very, very astute. I think he's going to come up with a lot of situations where, like, you know, you cross the Rubicon and now you can't come back, Agent Cooper.
That toothpaste is not going back in the tube. And now you got to brush your teeth. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, they are oral surgeons too, by the way.
That's right. He would floss too. He would remember to floss.
If they were bigwigs from the Tri-Cities, they'd be involved with nuclear power. That's just sort of like the guy from lived in Washington for his whole life.
Right.
Because there's a big nuclear site out by Hanford in the Tri-Cities, which for as much as like the show touches on like weird types of energy, I'm surprised they didn't tap into that a little bit, but you know, whatever. That's what the Washingtonian would have wrote, not two guys from Hollywood.
Before we move on from this, I just want to say real quickly, I think Cooper's little philosophy about giving yourself a little gift every day is actually really beautiful. Yes. And great, and is basically how I survived graduate school.
Well, and it's funny because you'll see Truman especially kind of adhere to that philosophy as the show goes on. So, you know, just watch, you know, Truman and some of the, you know, upcoming episodes where he really takes that advice to heart. And I think that's good for everyone, you know, like give yourself the gift and don't plan it out. And I think Lynch works a lot like that too, right? We've seen it where he, you know, oh, like the strobe light's not working in this scene. Cool. We're going to add it and make it part of like what it is. You know, if we're going back to our sort of Cooper as Lynch, you know, grand theory, that ties right in as far as I'm concerned.
And there's talk of play in this episode. And so that fits as well. I think you see a lot of the characters at play, and there's a lot of bad things happening in this town. So I think they all need those moments of release.
But you also have to be careful, because when it's Ben Horn giving himself a treat, then things are going to go really bad. And we notice in this episode that Ben and Jerry are eating a big tub of ice cream.
That's right.
I always wonder if and I'd have to look up when the Ben and Jerry's ice cream actually sort of like became popularized, but you know,
I read it was a specific reference to Ben and Jerry. Ben and Jerry's was not very well known at that time, so it was an inside joke, but you know, the joke's on them.
Well, I hope you know, they give Lynch and Frost a little bit of profits from their ice cream then, man.
Red Room Crunch is my favorite.
There should be a Red Room Crunch. Could be like you'd have like a stripe of chocolate and a stripe of vanilla and like get them chevron like right inside the ice cream package.
Yeah, but they don't tell you what the crunch is.
We are going to talk about Sherilyn Fenn and her character, Audrey Horn. One of the things we did to sort of prepare for the episode is I asked all my co-hosts here who some of our favorite characters were, and we all put Audrey on the list. She's a major, major character in the show, and I'm glad we're finally going to sit down and, you know, talk to her a little bit or talk about the character. Sorry, we're not doing an interview with Sherilyn Fenn. That would be amazing. But one of the things that, you know, is sort of crucial to the development of the character is, you know, the casting. When Lynch cast the show, he didn't like look for particular types of actors. What he did was he just met with like, you know, young stars in Hollywood or young up and coming actors and talked to them for a little bit. And that was sort of, you know, how Sherilyn Fenn describes it. There's an article in the AV Club that we'll, you know, put in some of our show notes here where she's just like, hey, you know, Lynch sat us in a room and he just talked to us about stuff. And, you know, a couple of days later, he's like, I have written a part directly for you. So this, you know, this character was really, you know, he met Sherilyn Fenn, thought that she would have been perfect for Audrey and crafted the role specifically for her. And Sherilyn Fenn's like, that's the first and I think only time a director has done that. This is, you know, no, this is your role, nobody else's. So when they, you know, when Lynch met her, he saw something in her and kind of went from there. And I think in the original pilot, right, Audrey is really only meant to be sort of the, you know, the character we see at the Great Northern that comes in and interrupts her dad's meeting. and that's what it was going to be. But then when they met Sherilyn Fenn, they're like, no, we're going to sort of make the character larger and be more part of the show. And like, I'm not going to say it's like sort of a happy accident like some of the other things have been, but you know, we've seen it like with Cheryl Lee, and we've seen it with like, you know, Al Strobel and some of these other characters where, you know, it's a germ of an idea, but then sort of that alchemy between performer and like Lynch's vision, and it becomes a much, much larger role. So that's definitely sort of where the origins of the character come from. And of course, they're like really persnickety about like a lot of the details. Like they were saying that they couldn't find like the right type of saddle shoes for Audrey in the first episode in the pilot where we see her. So they took like Oxfords and painted them, right? They're, you know, they were really that obsessive with, you know, her detail. And she's probably too, like, you know, maybe like some of the more like gifable like characters. If you look up like, you know, Sweater Girl, right, you're gonna see Audrey Horne, you know, when you like are looking for an internet gif or something like that. So it really, I think, is like a testament to just like Lynch's vision and like Fenn's performance that this character is like live beyond sort of the, you know, the short life of the original broadcast of the show, and, you know, grown on to be, aside from maybe Cooper, I would say the second most iconic character in Twin Peaks. I'm not the first person to sort of float what I'm going to say here about Audrey. I did read it in a Guardian article from this year, actually, but, you know, I see her as a chaos agent, right? She, you know, Audrey is definitely a character that I think almost likes to, you know, start trouble or start situations for the sake of like starting trouble or starting a situation. We saw that right in the, you know, the pilot episode where she's sort of disrupting the meeting. I think, I forget if we've seen this or not, but there's a scene where she's with Donna in the double R and she like puts a pencil through the coffee cup and then like takes it out. And you're just like, yep, that's an Audrey sort of a you know, thing right there. And it almost seems like her interest in, you know, the investigation is really no more than to like sort of like maybe impress Cooper, but also to sort of like scratch an itch, right? Like, you know, I need to find out about this one-eyed Jackson. I need to do these things. And so, you know, what do we think about sort of her being like an agent of chaos? And like, what does that say in terms of her morality? Do we think she's good or bad? Do we think it's a teenager acting out? You know, guys, what do you think about what we've seen about Audrey Horne thus far?
Well, I think she's one of the most interesting characters because she starts rather two-dimensionally, but then evolves a lot. And by this episode in particular, there's something really interesting going on. I have I have kind of a theory about Audrey, and this is just my personal theory. It doesn't have anything to do with film theory. But what I think you could almost say Audrey's in kind of a superposition of being bad and being good. At like both things are possible at the same time. And I think chaos is exactly where she starts, but she's like a quantum state of badness and goodness. And there's this tug of war throughout this whole period, right? And sometimes she uses her badness for badness, but she has never gone all the way down the Laura Palmer path. But in the scene with Cooper this week, there is this interesting thing in the presence of his moral code, his chivalry, what he says, and his vulnerability. I mean, he really shows her vulnerability that he shows almost no one else. He says what he says, and then we see her sort of go from being this dangerous vixen character into an earnest and very genuine, if troubled, young woman. And I think that even when she is doing, you know, her manipulation subsequent to this, you know, she there's something about her, that quantum state has sort of collapsed. And so she has chosen maybe a good path. I don't know. We'll see.
One of the things from the oral history of Twin Peaks by Brad Dukes, Lynch expressly states that Audrey is a virgin and that like Cooper is sort of like her first great love. So it's not expressly said in the show, but I think you're, you know, kind of meant to put the pieces together in that way. And so, you know, it's funny how she uses, I think, some of her sexuality, because you clearly see in this episode that she can manipulate pretty much any man she needs. Like there's this poor sap in the department store and some of the other things. Jennifer, why don't you add to that, since I see you're like wanting to jump in here?
I think she's a really powerful character and very much in control. And, you know, she manipulates her way into getting an appointment with Black Rose. And Black Rose says something to the effect of, "You're not shy, are you?" You know, like this could be potentially a very scary mission, going into a brothel and, you know, where women are ostensibly being manipulated. And Audrey is at ease in this environment. And like you mentioned, Jonathan, in the department store, she manipulates Battis, you know, by threatening if she's not given a job at the perfume counter where she wants, then she's going to make up a story about him tearing off her clothes. So on the one hand, she's very powerful. I also want to go back to something I've talked about before, about some of the women being the super sleuths. And so we've seen her as a super sleuth in a couple of different guises. So in a prior episode, she literally looks like Nancy Drew from a 1940s book cover. You know, the way she's dressed and everything is very innocent looking, but also very much in control and smart and perceptive. But in this episode, it's more, you know, in the black dress and, you know, a different sort of undercover agent than Nancy Drew, for sure.
I think part of what makes her interesting, though, is that she feels very three-dimensional, right? She's not just like smart and in control and beautiful and witty and a super sleuth, right? She is all of those things. But there's also what makes her feel genuine to me is that there's also like a vulnerability there. Right. If we think about why is it that she ends up going to Cooper's room in the first place, if you recall, the last thing we saw of her before that in the previous episode was her weeping after seeing Leland having this breakdown on the dance floor. Right. And so, you know, I think you're right on, Jonathan, that she absolutely is this agent of chaos. And, you know, she's got this itch to scratch and she wants to impress Cooper. And I think all of that is true. But I think also inside there, and part of what makes her believable, is that there is this kind of like vulnerable teenage girl who's hurt because of her terrible father and her relationship with him. And that to me is similar to how we were talking about how on another show, Cooper would just be this straight down the line, like perfectly moral, two-dimensional lawman. I think on another show that was less well-written and less well-considered, she would just be this like super sleuth vixen. But there's an emotional complexity as well that is part of what makes her and I think the show itself stand out.
Yeah, I think you're dead on. You know, the other thing, and this ties into sort of the vulnerability and the emotional complexity that you're speaking of here, Damon, is, you know, I think that at least for me, like why I connect with Audrey a whole lot is, you know, she reminds me of the Disney princess Belle from Beauty and the Beast. And at the very beginning of that movie, you know, she sings a song where she says, "There must be more than this provincial life." You know, and I mean, I grew up in a small town and, you know, I definitely like could not wait to get out, you know, and
same.
I know, Damon, we went to high school together, you know, Audrey is unique among the characters in Twin Peaks, where I think she's really like one of the few that expresses a desire to leave, to look to the future, to do something better. I don't think she always knows exactly what that is or what form that's going to take. But to me, it's like a big, like motivating factor for Audrey is like, what is my future going to be like? What's life beyond this small town? And I think, you know, sort of like Belle in Beauty and the Beast, or maybe if you want to compare it to Alice from Alice in the Wonderland, you know, once she sort of takes some of these roads down, you know, she doesn't necessarily know where she's going to end up. Right. So, you know, I think that also makes her like a noir hero where, you know, like she starts in one place and end somewhere that she did not necessarily expect and maybe doesn't exactly know how to get out of, which, you know, leads to the cherry stem scene, which, by the way, Sherilyn Fenn can't do. They had like a prop in there. Machen Emmett could do it. And apparently the writer of the episode, Harley Payton, like saw one of his friends do it at a diner and worked it in the show.
And you're talking about these paths that Audrey could take as far as escaping. And I'm struck by the fact that in a prior episode, there's a conversation in the girls' room at school where there's talk of both Audrey running off with the circus and also running off with Agent Cooper for a life of mystery, you know, and those are both very different adventures. So I think that that touches on what you're saying about how there are many, many different ways that she could be expressing this desire to flee.
And, you know, I don't think she expects to end up sort of in the clutches of Blackie at the, you know, One-Eyed Jack's being like, you know, she sees right through her story and right through her BS. She's just like, you're like, Audrey, what you going to do, girl? Like, you're in this situation. How are you going to get out of it? And so it's, you know, I think, you know, she has a real, I think, childlike view of like, oh, I can be in a circus or be with Agent Cooper. And so she doesn't always, you know, she's thinking to the future, but maybe not exactly like, oh man, if I do this, this is what could happen. And so it's like a lot of like great tension with like think sort of like some of the vulnerability and the innocence of the character versus like the really adult situation she ends up in. I'm going to float a theory just to sort of keep in the back of your head here as the show progresses. And Colin, I think it touches a little bit on what you were saying last week about like, you know, maybe there's like music or, you know, that's sort of existing outside the realm of Twin Peaks. Do we think Audrey exists in a different show altogether or that, you know, she's part of a separate narrative? I'm just going to throw that out there, right? Because, you know, we see, you know, in Zen and the Art of, or Zen and the Skill of Catch a Killer, where she's dancing to Audrey's dance and, you know, really kind of gets wrapped up in sort of like, you know, listening to that music. I'm going to say, watch out for that kind of stuff. Do we think she's sort of having her own adventure separate from everything else that's going on?
It would certainly be interesting to see a different version of the show that's written from the perspective of her as the central character.
Like if they did like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern with like, you know, but instead of like Cooper, it's Audrey.
Right. Where Cooper is the secondary character and she's the primary character. I think that would actually be really, really interesting to watch.
When we were doing our favorite characters, I was thinking I would totally watch a spinoff show with Hawk and Audrey solving crimes on the road.
Absolutely.
Well, and speaking of spinoffs, Lynch's film Mulholland Drive was originally pitched as sort of Audrey Goes to Hollywood. So there's, you know, they had designs for the character maybe beyond Twin Peaks itself. So,
which fits right into that noir genre. Another great picture. And actually, you know, that's a great point, Jonathan, to raise that movie because that is very much about what the characters are experiencing and what is really happening. And this is another thing that Lynch does a lot and does well. And I just want to quickly flag, I think there's a character there's another blink and you'll miss it moment that stood out to me in this episode. And your question made me think that, but about this character, when Maddie is sneaking out of the house, there's this moment where it turns out Leland is sitting there in the dark and he turns his head and you sort of see the light. He's still in the dark room, but it's some light from the street lamp or something. He sees her, he just looks at her. And then he turns his head and he sinks back into the darkness. And I it's so creepy. I didn't see it the first time through, but the second time I was watching it, I was like, what is happening? What movie is he in? Like, holy crap. You know, and then we're on to something comical. And, you know, that's part of this magic is like Lynch is giving us all these genres, all these characters, all these intense stories, and it really gets into the human brain. Like we can't look away.
Watch Mulholland Drive. I think a nice question to ask is, was Audrey supposed to be the Laura Elena Herring character, or was she supposed to be the Naomi Watts character? Because I think you can make arguments for both.
So I actually have a title for my part. Is it live or is it Memorex? Recording, playback, and feedback. And for the first six episodes, I've really been struck by the constant use of telephones. I've been wanting to talk about that. And the telephones are a portal for myriad forms of communication, including secret messages and spying. Many of the characters have multiple phones, sometimes in the same room. And we don't know. They could be extensions or separate lines. We don't know for sure. And it leads us to believe that there are different channels of communication at play. We also see intercom systems, which work as both listening devices and broadcast devices in the Martell household. And the sheriff's station has telephones, a duophone, speakerphone, and a public address system. And of course, Cooper's mini tape recorder is a constant, with him using it to dictate messages to Diane. But by episode 7, audio communication takes on a new flavor with a heightened use of audiovisual tools. And this is what I'm going to talk about today. While Twin Peaks the show has a retro feel, this week we see more instances of the modern world and technology, including a police radio scanner, micro cassette recorder, boombox, reel-to-reel recorder, video camera, TVs, a VCR, a computer, and even a big tangle of phone wire in Emery Battis's closet where Audrey is hiding. This tech is used in different ways for straight-up communication, for eavesdropping, or for trickery. And then Waldo the Minor Bird is also a recording and playback device with his ability to mimic voices. So he's like a tape recorder, tape player as well, but he only functions when he's in a playful mood. When Cooper sets up his voice-activated microcassette recorder to capture Waldo speaking, we get even more levels of recording and playback. Waldo speaks, the recorder starts, and we hear Waldo imitating Laura's voice. On his contraband scanner, with the PA button pressed, Leo listens in to chatter at the sheriff's department. He overhears Lucy on the phone telling someone the bird is a witness. Leo races to the station, silencing Waldo with a shotgun, which is caught on tape, but not until after Waldo, in Laura's voice, says, "Leo, no." And audio and video play a vital role in tricking the AV nerd Jacoby this week, with imitations of Laura on both VHS and over the phone used to lure him out. We've seen him with headphones and stereo gear in the past. He has and uses a VCR. And notably, he's shown watching the soap opera Invitation to Love at night, while we see other characters watching it in real time during the day. So remember, this is 1989 on the show, and so he would have had to program his VCR to record it in order to view it later, since this is way before things like TiVo and streaming television. And as far as audio, he has his patient Laura submit diary-like tapes to him. In this episode, we hear one of these messages, one of these recordings, while James, Maddie, and Donna listen to it on a realistic brand boombox. Maddie later uses the memory of the sound to realistically mimic the Laura who she hears on the tape. Her phone call using this disguised voice causes Jacoby to venture out so that the crew can search for Laura's missing last recording. And then finally, we hear breakdowns in this whole system with feedback and interference. First, it's Cooper's voice and then literal feedback while Cooper is outfitted with a wire. As he tests the microphone hidden under his shirt before his trip to One-Eyed Jack's, we hear his voice and then feedback over the public address speakers at the station. There's also intermittent static and loss of picture as Jacoby watches a silent videotape of ghostly Laura in the form of costumed Maddie on his twin digital audio tracking VCR. In neighboring scenes, we hear multiple eerie screeching noises in the woods while we watch Maddie, Laura at the gazebo, and then what sounds like breathing, maybe. While it's perhaps a reminder that the Laura we see is a distortion, it doesn't explain the noise in the woods. And the episode ends in an unsettling manner as we are left to wonder about that, almost like an auditory cliffhanger. So I'd love to hear from all of you about what you think about the use of audio and video in this episode and what you make of that feedback sound in the woods. How is that all connected?
First of all, I just want to call attention. I think this is that this is great that you're pulling this out, because this is actually something we've seen in previous episodes too. It's really stepped up in this episode. But if we think back to the pilot, when the mayor is trying to use the microphone at the town hall meeting, He also experiences feedback and auditory distortion. And then just one or two episodes ago, at the Great Northern in the party with the Icelanders, I think it's Jerry who is trying to use the microphone and it's not working for him either. And he kind of bangs it on the podium and also creates a feedback sound when he does that. So this definitely seems like a sort of running motif, although it's really stepped up here. As far as that sound in the woods, I had always thought that that was soundtrack, not a sound that the characters actually heard, but obviously it puts the scene in a really different context if that's a real sound as opposed to soundtrack.
It feels different than the soundtrack. And what I'm wondering actually from some of you who've seen this many times is if we actually hear that feedbacky sound. I feel like we've heard it before, but I can't recall when. We hear it three times at the end of this episode, and I don't know if we heard it in a prior episode.
You know what it reminds me of, and I don't know if this is it, but when they stop the blade at the mill, when Josie turns off the mill, and there's that kind of screeching metallic sound.
It's like a blade stopping.
Very similar to that. I don't know that it's the same thing, though.
I love that you're pulling this out, Jennifer, and this is one of those things that I just completely missed. It would have been transparent to me, except for you laying it out. And you know, suddenly all kinds of things start getting connected. This is one of the reasons the show is so great. And it reminded me that one of the very first things, one of the very first things that Lucy ever says is that she's patching a call through to that telephone, the one sitting over there, not the one over there. And you think, and of course, you know, you think it's just the quirkiness of Twin Peaks, but now that we have this whole theme of doubling and different channels and different perspectives, it makes me wonder like, oh man, in Twin Peaks, you could pick up the wrong phone and suddenly go down a very dark path.
Well, and in this episode, she talks about the switchboard being busy that day. So she calls out the switchboard and I understand audio, but I have been racking my brain trying to figure out how some of the feedback actually happened in this episode. You know, so Cooper is getting wired, and when he's on this journey, Hawk is listening to him from a communications van where he has a reel-to-reel tape going, and Hawk is wearing headphones. But when they're testing this out in the office, that sound ends up over the PA in the station. And similarly, Leo has a police scanner, either it's a scanner or it's a police radio, and he can hear phone calls from the station. So I would love to know behind the scenes how all of this actually happens, because some of this feedback, there's literal crossing of wires, and we don't know how these wires have been crossed. I don't know if Leo had somebody in the station. There's an episode where we see somebody painting, and I was wondering like, oh, is that the episode where he's somehow switching the wires so that he can eavesdrop? You know, it's a big mystery to me.
I'm going to pay attention to some of your sound cues here. I don't want to like reveal too much, because I think it might dip into like spoiler territory in regards to some of the more supernatural elements of the show, and I think we can maybe save some of those reveals for when they get revealed. A couple of little things, like I work with I'm a security officer, so I use a walkie-talkie every day, and those things have like incredible range. Leo probably can like literally just pick up on the channel that like the officers are having their radio communication on. That definitely would not surprise me in terms of that. I also wanted to drop in just a little bit of trivia that we were talking about, where Cheryl Lee is the voice of Waldo the Minor Bird, which, you know, is yet another way she gets worked into the narrative of the story. And, Waldo Lidecker is a reference from the film Laura, which came out in 1944, directed by Otto Preminger. It's also where they got the inspiration for Laura Palmer's name was from that movie. So, definite couple of little bits of trivia. in there in that regard. But I mean, and Lynch is always, you know, he's a sound guy, man. That's it's, you know, he, I think, has a lot of fun with like a lot of the tape recorders and the reel to reels and the phone switchboards and that sort of stuff. So that's an itch I think he scratches in almost every one of his works, is this like fun and interesting and unexpected ways to play with sound.
Well, and in a lot of his projects, and certainly in Twin Peaks, there are these kind of just weird distorted sounds happening in the background. Sometimes you can't even hear them that well unless you're listening to the episode pretty loud, but there's some like kind of whooshing sounds and rumbling sounds and things like that, that sort of make the sound of life feel distorted. It's funny, I was sitting in my kitchen early in the morning a few days ago, and I was running the dishwasher, and it struck me how much the sound of that was sort of like these rumbling sounds that are in the background of Twin Peaks and a lot of other Lynch projects. And so, you know, it made me wonder if he's sort of calling attention to just sort of the background noise in life that we normally tune out. And certainly, you know, the distortion we hear on recordings and telephones and microphones and audio cassettes in this episode are just seem like they could just be a heightened example of that.
Yeah, you make me think of Eraserhead that has some very eerie, there are industrial sounds in that film that are really important. But back to the sound design on this episode, there are a lot of things that you can, as you mentioned, Damon, there are a lot of things in this episode that are barely audible. So Lucy gets a phone call from her doctor, and we can only hear a small fraction of what's going on that phone call. And in the department store at the perfume counter, a customer comes up and interacts with Audrey, and the sound is so strange. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's almost like the customer is using a different type of microphone in a way. The voice
I noticed that too.
Is very different. And also felt like something out of a Hitchcock movie for some reason. And then Jenny, who also works at the perfume counter, her voice and her whole conversation style is really muted and completely different from everybody else. I mean, she's almost like, it's almost like she is actually from 1989. You know, she's using modern language, and but she's very, very quiet. So there, I think that plays into this whole idea of distortion, sound being distorted in so many ways in this episode. So to conclude today's episode, we're going to talk about another twist, an interesting part of the episode that maybe a topic that we haven't gotten to, something a little bit quirky. And something that I really noticed was costuming and disguises this week. You have a lot of characters going undercover, pretending to be people who they are not. And one thing that stood out to me about that was some cartoon references at One-Eyed Jack's. You hear Cooper and Big Ed are in disguise, and Blackie asks, "Are you a cop?" to Ed, "Or you look like a cop." And Cooper then says, "I'm the cop." And she says, "You look more like Cary Grant." And then he ends up introducing them as Barney and Fred, which is clearly a Flintstones reference. And Cary Grant, there's actually in the Flintstones, there's a character, Cary Granite, who is Fred Flintstone's stand-in in an episode. So, I mean, to me, some of these disguises are just cartoonish and ridiculous. Like, of course, Blackie is going to know who Fred and Barney are in the same respect that she's going to know who Hester Prynne is. So it's almost, and Ed has a horrible wig. So I'm curious if the rest of you noticed that some of these disguises were kind of ridiculous, or if there are other things you noticed about clothing.
I had two things. One is, yeah, the wig and the mustache that Ed wears. Cooper doesn't wear a disguise except for glasses, I guess, which, I mean, maybe that's like a Superman reference there, speaking of cartoons, right? But putting Ed in this wig as if somehow she would recognize this gas station owner, it seems really unnecessary. The other thing that stands out to me is Donna's like going out into the night where she like thinks that a blue ball cap is gonna make her like sneakier or obscure her identity in some way. You know, you don't see her wear anything like that at any other time in the show. It's clearly like her go out to do things sneaky at night cap. And it's really ridiculous.
I think Maddie's disguise is, I mean, she's literally dressing up as Laura, and it's so funny too, because like, you know, I almost am like, to stick with like the Disney princess thing, I'm like, man, she's done looking like Elsa here with all them like huge sweaters and just like, and I'm like, I know in February and March in Washington State, especially Eastern Washington, it is cold, especially at night, but that almost seemed like overkill on the layering, even for, you know, Washington State, where if you don't layer, you're going to be cold.
I'm from California, and one of the first trips my family took to the East Coast, my mom was so worried we were going to freeze, and she had us in like two sweaters, like two double layers of sweaters, and we were so bulky and so hot, and it's exactly what that scene is like. She looks so bulky. It's just not really, yeah, it's weird.
So I have a couple of fashion-related things. I'm so glad we finally got to this. And a couple of other items that I just can't resist throwing in terms of fashion. Speaking of Maddie, in the previous episode, I neglected to mention that Maddie is wearing like leopard slippers. Maybe they have claws and dots on them. I'm thinking she has leopard slippers she's sneaking around in. Which is kind of adorable.
Like maybe a snow leopard. I was trying to figure out that too, because they're white, but they have little claws on them.
That's what it is? Yeah.
And she's hilarious. Padding down the stairs.
Yes. Yeah. Hilarious. The other fashion thing, and I've been wanting to say this since the beginning, but have not been able to, is Truman has a cowboy hat, but it's this teeny tiny, like, one third size cowboy hat. And I don't know from cowboy hats. Maybe that's totally normal, but to me, it looks like a visual joke. You know, he's like it's that Western theme, but then his hat is so tiny, you know, and I don't know, has anybody seen that specific kind of hat before?
No, and I mean, Truman is so weirdly dressed, because his sheriff uniform is almost like it's like a khaki colored mechanics like coverall like thing, you know, it doesn't seem like it's a cop outfit, and he's got that big coat that he always wears.
Like, he has that coat, right, with that like proto 90s fabric pattern, and I swear to God, I had that coat like 3 years later.
I mean, he looks like a logger. Like a couple other fashion tidbits, and one, you know, it's no surprise we're talking about Audrey and fashion here, because she's probably, I think, you know, the most iconic character in the show in terms of fashion. There's still girls that dress just like Audrey Horne. If you go to Seattle and go out, hopefully soon when we can all go out again into like bars or restaurants, you will see, you know, little Audrey Horns everywhere, and they probably haven't even watched the show. Like, that's the thing, right? Like, it's, you know, this, like, it's such an iconic look with like the sweater and the, you know, the saddle shoes, that like people probably don't even know what they're copying in, you know, when they're doing that. You know, I also really love like the waitress uniforms that Shelley and Norma wear. I mean, it's just like, if you were to like cook up like what a small town waitress uniform looks like in, you know, some small town in America, it's those, right? That's, you know, that's the ones that I'm thinking of in my head, is what Norma and Shelley are wearing. So, you know, the show really, I think, takes pains to like try to think like what's classic looks for like these characters. And yeah, it's set in, well, the show's set in 89, came out in the 90s, but I think they really try to have an eye for like, you know, sort of classic fashion, like stuff for all time. Although there is totally ridiculous things like, the outfit that Jenny was wearing today, like that like crazy print and like that weird red like piece of fabric that was in her hair. I'm like, what in the world? Like, this is straight out of like 1990, like never coming back sort of thing.
Yeah, it was like, red ribbon kind of through her French braided hair.
So as we start to wind up the episode here, I'll take that cue and mention one thing from the scene at Horn's department store, where, and this is just a small thing, but it stood out to me, where Audrey is talking to the customer that you mentioned, Jennifer, and it's this very sort of weird 50s-esque thing where the customer's turned away and the weird audio. And Audrey says, here, try this perfume. Try this one. It smells like the woods. I was like, oh my God, don't wear that perfume, lady. Horrible things will happen.
Like, oh, she's such a horrible saleswoman. But it was
I know. In that scene that the rest of you notice, there's a very 80s fashion moment. You have an ad for an Invitation to Love perfume. So it's basically a full size. It's a Dynasty. I forget which character on Invitation to Love it is, but she's got, you know, like big curly black hair. And it's like a full size cardboard cutout next to the perfume counter advertising an Invitation to Love perfume. So you have some of these 80s fashion moments, you know, like Blackie seems more like in an 80s Dynasty kind of outfit. And then this Invitation to Love ad as well.
That's awesome. I totally missed that. That would be Jade, presumably. Is that right? Jade, the evil twin.
I don't know. I get mixed up. I'm having a hard time. I need Lucy to give me the whole rundown of Invitation to Love, because I sort of am losing track. But it's always a pleasure.
I had a couple more things on fashion. One, for as much as I have a hard time with Joan Chen and the Josie character, like, always amazing looks, right? She's one of those actresses that, like, clothes just look amazing on no matter what you put her in. And, like, they put her in some really funny stuff, too. It's just like, you're like, only Joan Chen could pull this off. So that's, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the best qualities about that character. It's just that, you know, she just looks great no matter what you put her in. I also pulled up an article here. It's from theobserver.com. It came out in 2017 in advance of the third season. And one of the costume designers on the third season also did the costuming for the Come As You Are video with, like, you know, like she picked out Kurt Cobain's cardigan. The costume designer there is Nancy Steiner. And Lynch works with, Patricia Norris was his longtime costume designer for the pilot and all that stuff. So, I mean, like, this is stuff that, like, you know, they're truly, like, trendsetting here, right? It isn't just, you know, like, oh, look at this goofy fashion from, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, which it was. But, you know, you still see some of this stuff, like, on people today. You know, it really, really ahead of its time.
Well, and I think people, and I think this even ended up on other teen shows later, where people would talk about a Twin Peaks look. Like, it was in the vernacular as a particular style of dress. So you're right. It was very influential in that way.
So just to wrap us up today, I have one tiny tidbit I can't resist mentioning, which is that Emery Battis is the man at Horn's department store who is recruiting hospitality girls. I looked up the word Battis, and it's actually an African bird with a black mark on over its eyes, on its face, like a black mask. And if we recall, just because we've been talking about this, Cooper says in this episode, Doc Hayward says, do you want to feed Waldo? Cooper says, I don't like birds. So we here at Back to the Double R are keeping our eyes on the birds, and we're going to go give ourselves a little present. We'll see you next week. Thanks for coming along.